Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Really, really, really delighted to welcome to the panel for questions Wendy Yip, who's our Director of International Development here at Aston University, and Dr. Matthew Hall, who is the Director of International Relations at Aston Business. Sorry, I had to read that because both of their titles are very similar and I didn't want to get it the wrong way around. I think you probably will work out which one's Wendy and which one's Matthew. Well, I hope you can anyway. So, first question, please. I have some if nobody else does, but hopefully some people have some questions.
I think David's presentation got this from
everybody. Well, I'll start with a question, if I may, then. I'm actually quite interested in what the next big growth areas might be and where international students might come from. We all know about BRIC countries and all lots of Chinese students, but where might we be recruiting students from in 10 years' time? Maybe if David's just spoken, Wendy or Matthew might have a view, and then we can come back to David.
Potentially, yes, it depends how the reference. I guess it's difficult to tell, I suppose, because things move quite quickly. And I think it's not simply a case of looking at, in terms of nationalities where students come from, but also the style. I mean, what David has been talking about is the type of learning. I think that actually will have an impact as to where they will come from. Students have different expectations from their learning. Some are far more open, I think, to more innovative learning than others. And I think that will have an impact on how universities deliver in the future. But if you're looking at sort of traditional recruitment, at the moment, without a doubt, I think it's going to be Africa, which is still very much untapped. It already features some of the fastest growing recruitment for universities, but it's massive, and we haven't really scratched the top of the ticket really. And there are massive challenges there, and there are issues with how we operate and how we deliver and how we manage that process. And I think that's going to be one of our biggest challenges. So Africa, I think for most universities is going to be a big one.
Is it switched on?
Yes.
And one other country, Myanmar, Burma, which is massively growing now. I don't know if the students, if universities can now receive applications for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of students now going out of the country.
That would take probably a little bit longer to develop, I suspect, but it's getting there, I think. The infrastructure, I think, is perhaps perhaps a little bit more back a few years.
I'm not really sure that that's true.
Okay.
There are two UK universities now running degree programmes already in Myanmar. So the TNE programmes that they have developed. And last year, 1,800 students from Myanmar went to Thailand. And over 3,000 went to Singapore. So they are moving out of the country. They are starting to move. Just they're not moving far enough.
Yes.
Okay, are there any questions from the floor?
So, sort of related really to the opportunity, it's the opposite end really, but it's very reliant on Chinese students at the moment. And a lot of us are worried about, oh, it's a couple of years and it's going to go down, unless Chinese build up their infrastructure. Do you have a more informed perspective
of Chinese numbers coming in?
And
how we deal with it?
Yeah, in terms of actually, is that entirely true? Is it sort of certain areas of the market and certain subject areas and certain parts of the country? I think it's quite a bold statement to say that all those units are just going to start.
I don't think it will come back to that. I think David and I both have been working in the Asian market for long enough. So certainly we've been probably both been involved in recruitment from China probably for the last 15 plus years. And what I think is that it's shifting. Yes, without doubt shifting.
But no, I don't think the numbers will decrease. I think the patterns will change. We're already seeing that they're becoming much more sophisticated in terms of what they're wanting to study and how they want to study. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that means that we have to just engage in a more innovative way. So no, I don't think the Chinese numbers will decline.
I truly understand the motivation always of some of the international students coming to Costa to study it. Some of our postgraduate Chinese students, I think what's most important to them appears to be getting the certificate from a prestigious institution rather than the what happens to them while they're here and the way they get taught and what they're learning. It's kind of a bit of paper at the end. Do you think then can people understand looking 10 years ahead what is motivating people to come here in order to be able to predict where they are coming from and what happens? Any observations around that?
I think this is an interesting point because in the past we've relied upon students from countries like China coming to study in the UK because they're coming to study in English. The question is, where are they now going? And increasingly, they're facing competition from institutions in Europe that are now teaching in English. So it's not so much that necessarily the numbers will decrease, but the pool of institutions that they're able to choose from is increasing. So that's a good impression. The other thing that I'd like to point out is that there was a perception that Chinese students would need to leave their own country in order to get a quality education. But as we see, the quality of Chinese institutions rising, increasingly Chinese students are choosing to stay within their own borders in order to get education, and indeed many of the partners that we work with are beginning to teach in English as well. And also you can see the same happening in India. So I think rather than just thinking of this market being static, we also need to think of it as a global market, and as you say, understand the motivations of these students and the types of decisions that they make when choosing where to go, as well as sort of whether or not to stay in their own country.
As our fees rise, and we've heard presentations about the ceiling maybe rising, we've already seen some poor students because you've gone abroad. What kind of views have Carl got on the exodus of UK-based students going abroad because of fees?
What exodus? My kids are just at the stage of choosing to go to university, and I try to get them interested in the idea that they might go to Holland or Scandinavia, and they're not interested. So it comes down to the point that David made about trying to get UK students, and indeed students from any English-speaking country, outside their own border and getting that international experience. I think that it's part and parcel of the problem that we have in English-speaking countries with not speaking other languages and not having that confidence to go and study in other parts of the country. So I have to say I'm not witnessing an exodus yet.
I don't think that. I think there will be a big change. I think for several reasons. One, what I mentioned, that I think the £9,000 fee alone is going to make students go abroad because of the independence aspect. But I think secondly, I think Canadian universities were here last year trying to recruit UK students and offering fees at £3,000 or £4,000. So even students who didn't want a really international experience, but those that were on the margin that weren't sure they could afford £9,000, could go to Canada and get a good degree for half the price of doing it in the UK. And I think students will move. And I think we have to address that in the short term, not in the medium term.
I think it's increasing. I think at the moment what is perhaps stopping it is lack of information. That I think our students, UK students, don't know where to go. If you think about where they get their information, I think at the moment a lot of them are using their careers counsellors in their school. And at the moment it's very much driven towards the UK education system. So therefore there's a lack of international universities approaching schools. That will come, and that definitely will happen. You know, the Australian universities have banded together and have started touring, and have started doing exhibitions in the UK. We had the Australian universities setting up in the city centre in Birmingham only a few months ago, approaching, basically promoting Australian education. So it will come,
but the things are the same. But
it makes it stupid in Australia, the same exposure there as it is.
But not in Canada.
And not for Germany.
Yeah,
and some of the other Europeans. And not for Singapore or Malaysia. Korea is one of the biggest importers of students now. And Korean visas should be our visa. Our visa are at the top end. And if you were looking purely on a larger point of view, you can go abroad and do, hopefully, you can do, or you can do a degree abroad for half the price of doing it in the UK.
And I think as time goes on, it will become more sophisticated, where I suspect that students won't just look at the fees, they'll be looking at the whole package and what the experience they're getting. Because they're looking for value for money, because they're saying, well, I'm going to have to pay 9,000. What am I going to get for that 9,000? Or whatever it is by the time that that comes off. But if I have choices, if I have an opportunity to go overseas, where can I go? And what do I get out of it? And what added benefit do I get? And so it may not just come down to the cost of it. It may be more expensive, but actually if the experience, perceived experience, far outweighs it.
What's your take on the Indian market? I'm reminded of an article that I read for the Hindu Times, a couple of articles there, and their advice to the Indian students who are contemplating coming to the UK was check the prospective university's balance sheet, because they were aware that a lot of universities are going through it financially. They don't have the luxury of having a big bank balance and the danger. And they were actually saying to students, you know, check it out. And the other thing that ended, another separate article, was that Britain doesn't welcome you anymore. So we have this political perception that we're closed to certain markets because of your nationality. I mean, we even see it today with David Cameron talking about extending this issue around Romanians and Bulgarians, people who have the right to move here and study. And, you know, I've a Hungarian student who's a graduate from Northern University doing an MBA program and about to go off to China. And in fact, I just was on the way up here to see if we're the parent of this student, highly concerned about what would happen when he came back from China. Would he be welcome as a Hungarian student? It's a difficult one to answer, so I'm curious to know what your different perspectives are on those issues.
The Indian market overall is dropping dramatically, but if you look at it, the number of students coming to the UK to do undergraduate programmes is growing significantly, actually very, very fast, but not as fast as the overall drop of the postgraduate students. We saw India as a postgraduate market. It's changing to become an undergraduate market, but it's going to be a big one.
Yeah, and I would support that. I've been talking to a number of my colleagues in other universities, looking at comparing statistics, and certainly a large number have said postgraduate numbers have either remained fairly static or declined, but certainly undergraduate there has been an increase. And if you look at many universities, they have shifted their emphasis towards undergraduate promotion, targeting the schools, targeting the standard 12 schools in order to capture those students. It's also about perception. You know, the Indian press in particular is very quick to capture on negative UK press, and the Times of India in particular is very, very quick on that. But what we have to do is as a sector is respond and make sure that we try to respond as positively as possible. We don't have, like, you know, there's been a lot of press about the negativity of our border agencies regulations and changes, but we don't help the out because we know about it, we talk to all and sundry about it, and actually we perpetuate that problem. I think we've just got to be smart about it, because international media is picking up on this, and we've got to be careful about how we portray UK PLC. I imagine it would be much like when you have international students applying with international degrees applying for jobs here. There will no doubt be organisations that will have a very narrow viewpoint of what are deemed as good universities and a recognisable university and recognisable qualifications. And I guess as a sector we will have to work together. And I think part of it will come down to working on what information we give to graduates. I was talking to some American universities and about that, about employability, and we were talking about how difficult it is for many American organisations in terms of recognising British degrees even. Because unless you're Oxford or the top names, they don't tend to recognise it. Who are you? We don't understand. We have a classification system. We don't understand that. Where's your GPA? And I think what we've got to look at as a university is look at what information we give to our graduates in order to make it transparent to employers. Now that's going to be fine if your institution is involved in a lot of TNE. So where you have a lot of students perhaps doing TNE, and you're able to provide quite a transparent transfer, I suppose, or positional information. The difficulty is where you've got UK student or any student who are doing their whole degrees in another country and come back with that. And that's going to be an issue.
A student that could go to, say, a top 20 or a top 30 university in the UK, there's no incentive to study abroad, is there? Because the graduate recruiters will be looking for students that are graduates from those, say, top 30 universities, in which case the top students aren't going to study abroad, and yet those same businesses are saying there isn't enough internationalisation for the students.
I think we might all give different answers to that. I would argue, and certainly this would be backed up by the CBI report last year, that what employers are looking for is international experience. They're not bothered what the subject is, they're not bothered what the degree classification is. They're looking for the ability to work with international coaches and to understand it. And if that is true, and that's what the CBI report said, then they're not going to care where they studied overseas. They're going to give preference to people who have studied overseas, to people who have studied in the UK.
But I would arguably also say that there are opportunities for us as UK universities to look at how we can internationalise our student body. You touched on this in your presentation, and I think there are many things that colleagues around the UK are doing, increasing our study opportunities, looking at how we can incentivise and motivate our students to go overseas for a short period. At Aston, we have a fairly ambitious target. By 2020, we actually want to give all of our students, in other words, we want 100% placement opportunity for all students. And that's a big ask. Now, I will also clarify it and say that actually we're redefining what we mean by placement. Because that's not possible if you're doing a 1 year master's, how are you going to do a placement year? That's not possible. And if you're doing a degree program like pharmacy, where we can't, it's not possible again. So we're redefining what we mean by placement. So we're looking at short grade programs. So you're looking at the fact that you develop it for over the summer period, we look at doing partnering with an institution that offers a summer university, a summer school program. So there are ways that we can do it. So we've got to rethink about how we're offering that international experience. And you know, you talked about the CBI report about languages, and that's something that we've identified at the university. And again, for I think this is the second year we've run it, is the languages for all, which is something that we've offered to all first-year students, incoming first-year students, that they have the opportunity to take up the language free of charge for the first year in order to get that going. We've been inundated, actually. Yeah. Yes, we've actually been inundated. Yeah. And that's...
But they stick at it, it's another
matter. Yes. But it's the fact that we've given them the opportunity, and what's the next stage is whether they will then pursue it after that. Because there are opportunities within the university for them to continue for a fee. But if we have at least whetted their appetite, and actually the students that are doing that Languages for All programme, it already awakens the international bug, as it were, because they're seeking out people that they can perhaps talk to, that they can interact with, and that's a start. We've got to break down those silos, those barriers, and anything you can do that will help spark it off is a bonus as well. That's what I think.
We know several institutions, Newcastle is one of them, is being quite involved in setting up international campuses or hubs. Is there any evidence to support that that's sort of sending recruitment the other way? I'd like to hear what you're hearing on
that.
It's a difficult question. And we've done the same. We haven't set up actually campuses, but we've done big joint ventures where we've got perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 students on a joint venture. And does it affect? No, I don't think it affects the recruitment. I think it offers a great opportunity to have two-way exchanges within that linked programme. And if they're doing your programme, so if it's a common curricula across two institutions, then it's very easy to exchange for short periods of time, which are much more acceptable. So, you know, I think the 1 year abroad, whilst it would be great to do, and do 1 year here, 1 year there, 1 year there, not all students are going to, you know, go for that, even though it can be cost effective. But to do short periods, I think that is becoming very, very, very popular. And that is possible from both sides. But in terms of our biggest student recruitment numbers would be where our biggest TNE numbers are.
Well, that'd be the last question. That'd be lovely. Thank
you. You mentioned collaborative partnerships, and obviously flying faculty are part of what we're now called to do. But that, again, is fraught with difficulties, because contractually, people aren't mandated to teach abroad. They can choose to out of goodwill and receive their recompense and work they want to do that. Where's the future plan faculty? Is it through mandated appointments, or is it, you know, going to carry on? Because clearly you have a contract with a delivery contract that then you have to fund from goodwill this end. So just your views on that would be welcome. If you haven't.
The Australians have a system of adjunct professors where they will look for really expats living in different countries, and they will appoint them as, they will go through a procedure of appointing them and vetting them, but they will appoint them as part-time lecturers for that institution. And this is very common in Hong Kong, in Malaysia, and quite a lot in Southeast Asia generally. The staff living in Thailand or living in Malaysia or wherever will go to the Australian universities, will be trained at the Australian universities, but will represent them back in the country that they live in. And that's one way forward. I don't think it's the only way forward, but that's one of the tools. But I think the second one is that
You look at the contracts for staff. I think if it's becoming core business, then we have to address that in the contract.
I personally, as a non-academic member of staff, so obviously I'm going to stir quite a lot of emotions on this one. I find it baffling that we adhere to an academic calendar when we're dealing in an international, on a global platform. You know, not everyone has the same academic year as us, and yet we impose that on our students and on our partners.
There
are ways. I think we could be more creative. I think we could look at, you know, splitting an academic year instead of into three teaching periods into four, let's say. So it includes a summer period. So the idea being is that you could still have effectively a 3-month period when you're not teaching, and you could still be doing research, for example. But it just may not be over the summer period. It just means that it frees up the fact that during that summer period we could have a core of academic staff who can either be teaching on campus. Because that's the other thing, you know, if we're talking about assets, fixed assets, the campus is empty over the summer period. It's going to waste. We're not creating finances for this. We should be able to bring students onto campus. But similarly, we should be able to facilitate TNE opportunities by allowing those sorts of activities to happen.
I think it's worth also reminding ourselves why we have the long summer vacation. And it's not an academic issue. What it was when universities were first, when Oxford and Cambridge and St Andrews first came about, the only people that went there were the farmers, the landed gentry, who wanted time off during the summer to supervise the farms. So the academic year was built around the people who went to the universities. And hundreds of years later, we see, oh, well, we must fill in that. And why isn't everybody else in the world doing the same as what we do? We have to address this.
I saw some recent research, I'm sorry, I can't remember the source, that was saying that in the TNE arrangements, local students are generally unhappy with the concept of flying faculty and the faculty coming in and going out. And I mean, I understand that it's important to have flying faculty, but it seems to me to be a stepping stone on the way to training local staff to do the courses. And my own view is that as far as possible, we should be moving students, not moving faculty, so students get the experience of working in a different culture. You know, that should be our principal focus, rather than
I think we need to internationalise our staff.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're in the quite a strong position here, already having a fairly international, you know, 45% of our staff are from overseas, so they need to get that international experience. But yes, I very much agree with you.
If I could stop you there, thank you because of the time. If you could all show your appreciation for David.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.